SC Podcast, episode number 22. I am Andrew, giving an overly dramatic introduction, and I am joined by Leftos.
Hello, this is the Master of the Universe. Be prepared to be destroyed.
And we also are joined by Ben.
Hello, I am the Unknown One.
The mystery!
Well, that's actually what Arcane stands for, so I'm living up to my name.
Okay. Ah. That's the reason why the video where you're getting drunk with the rest of the NLSC people is still private. You know, you're trying to remain unknown, just give us a slight glimpse of the thumbnail to the video. that small moment from the video, but nothing else.
Yes. Yep.
You mere mortals are not worthy. Secret. One does not simply watch Ben in a video.
No.
You must earn the right.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, NBA and stuff. The Heat are still winning, apparently. And the Lakers are very lucky, apparently. And what else? I guess more stuff.
We got a few things to talk about this week.
Bynum is still injured, apparently. Royce White is still complaining, apparently. And controversy. I'm looking through the notes and there's this bullet point. Bulls-Nuggets controversy. There's no controversy.
There was the offensive goaltending, not called at one end and then called at the
other. Oh, yes, that's right. I heard about that.
Well, you know, just because you got the call wrong once doesn't, you know, mean that you should get the call wrong twice.
Two wrongs don't make it right.
I can see how that affected the outcome of the game, and I can see people complaining about the wrong call, but I hate that people are complaining about the right call.
Well, it was just that it was handled differently.
No. I'm with you on that. I agree that if you get a call wrong and then you get the very same call right the next time, for the opposite team, you're affecting the result. But I want to see people complain about the wrong call being called wrong.
Agreed.
Not people complaining that the right call was called on the Bulls. You know, you have to pick your battles. You can't
And it was the right call. I absolutely goaltended the committed basket interference on that shot by Bellinelli. The controversy is kind of that with the replay rules about if you can't call it on the if they don't call a certain way on the floor, they can't review it. And so the Bulls were saying, review it. Look, Kufos definitely committed basket interference about 20 seconds earlier at the other end. And he did. The replay showed it. But the way it was called on the floor meant they couldn't review it and just said to Thibodeau, just go sit down. And then the fact it was a similar situation, but they saw fit to call it on the floor and then review it, I think it just sort of didn't sit well after the way it ended. Yeah, I mean, it was the right call, and that's why I can't complain about it too much. But I think the bigger point is the NBA should iron out some of these instant replay rules, because the instant replay is great, in my opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, it hasn't slowed the game down to a crawl. It's many times been able to make sure that the correct call has been made, so we should absolutely have it. But the technicalities of it, when you can call for the replay and when you can't and that kind of thing, I mean, that's why a lot of the example is the flagrant fouls. A lot of the times, if they suspect a flagrant foul, they have to call a flagrant one or flagrant two so they can go to the tape and say, okay, either upgrade it, downgrade it, or just say it was not a foul at all. Yeah. So there's all kinds of technicalities there that sometimes get in the way of saying, oh, well, something that perhaps should be reviewed isn't. So I think that's the main controversy here, because you certainly can't argue that the Bulls got the wrong call. It was just the way it came about. It was very unfortunate.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm going to take that side because the Bulls lost. So I'm not unbiased here. I certainly will not pretend to be unbiased in that. But I do believe in the instant replay. So, I mean, as long as they keep reviewing it in the off season and cleaning it up, so much the better.
Yeah.
And I think with the whole instant replay, you take into account the last two Miami games, that those crucial last second plays where it's determining who the ball came off.
Yes.
You know,
that
like the one against Boston with when it came off Jeff Green, and well, it looked like it came off Jeff Green. It went Boston's way, and then who was it against Cleveland? And that, you know, it was. There's no way fans could have been happy either way. I think if they felt the calls were wrong in that, it would just cause an upright for those two games, you know, being so close as they were. So I was thankful in a lot of ways they had those instant replays in those circumstances, because they were bloody tough calls on both ones. From the amount of times of replays and the angles that we looked at, it would have been tough for any ref to make a call on that.
Yeah, well, you think of all the times over the years that the ball has gone out of bounds off one play or has appeared to, and then while the referees are discussing it before they could review it, you'd see the TV replay, and clearly it went the other way or whatever, and they'd either change the call or not change the call and get it wrong. So, and considering how much we bitch about referees and how they impact the game, I think sometimes it's overblown. My old basketball coach used to say to us when we grumbled a bit about calls, he said, look, if you need the referee to get every single call right, you're not winning the game. You know, you need to be good enough to win a game without getting every single call right. And that's, I believe, true at every level of the game. As a teenager, as a teenager who was upset about the calls that some of the referees would make, it was a bit harder to see. But looking back at it now, being a bit older, yes, he was absolutely right about the situation. So.
Yeah. Basketball is so fast-paced that you forget about bad calls that happened earlier in the game that could have affected the result just as much as those two final calls.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I see discussion like that because soccer is so popular here in Greece. I see discussions about stuff that happened, you know, even in the first half or 30 minutes before the end or whatever, you know, and how much they had affected the game because... soccer is, you know, has fewer highlights, and the psychology of the team, you know, takes more of an effect in the long run because players are out there for 45 minutes at a time. They're not, you know, for short bursts with timeouts and stuff like that. And but, you know, we complain so much. I am saying that to agree with the sentiment that you can't be expecting to get for the referees to get all the calls right for your team in order to win. You're going through 48 minutes, you know, of pure game without counting, you know, all the stoppages at that, you know, end up making NBA games a three-hour and a half experience to watch. And you're going through such a long time and, you know, every call, whether right or wrong, is going to affect the outcome of the game. So I'm not saying it wasn't wrong what happened at the end, but you have to consider, you know, all the calls that might have gone the other way during the duration of the game.
And not just calls. The Bulls didn't make all their shots. So they could have made free throws or shots here and there. So
absolutely.
I will stop short of saying the Bulls were robbed, but it was because that's being too fanboyish, but it was unfortunate the way it came about. That's the way I'd put it. But these things happen. It's part of the sport, and you did pick yourself, dust yourself off, and go on to the next game.
Yeah. So, anyway, before we go into other stuff, let's wrap up the NBA discussion. Let's go through the NBA discussion first. Let's go through the subject that I want to discuss the least. The Heat are still winning. They apparently managed to overcome a 27-point deficit against the Irvingless, Varezaoless, and Waiterless Cavs, which is a big feat by anyone's measure. So I'm going to pass the torch, the microphone, to the Heat expert on the panel. Ben, how do you feel about the Heat's 24-game win streak? Can't they overcome the NBA record? And how do you feel specifically about overcoming a 27-point deficit against such a strong Cavs team? You feel proud? I'm being professional. Shut up. Stop laughing.
All right. Well, of course I'm going to be happy about a win, but yeah, the question does go, do they deserve to really lose against such an understrength team? I mean, it's a good preparation for playoffs and being able to try and overcome a 27-point deficit, but it shouldn't happen against the Cavs. Not this season, at least. Probably not for a few more either. But overall, I know they're going to take the win. I know they're not going to be consistent and smash every team by like 30 points. So there's going to be those off nights, and especially after a pretty hotly contested game against Celtics the day before, where Jeff Green went for 43 points, which was unbelievable in that for him, and he did play an awesome game. So I'll give him credit for that. So yeah, it's there are some questions, but it can be a good sort of character team building and stuff before the playoffs and that, with those little challenges and that, it's like to try and prepare them. Whether there was intent in getting down by such a large margin, I doubt it. There was probably like, you know, trying to come back from like a 10-15 point deficit, you know, just as prep kind of stuff. And it's like those little mental game challenges, you know, to try and get you guys motivated. But I also sort of stress that, you know, there's always going to be games where a team realistically will probably lose about four games that they shouldn't throughout the whole season and that. I'm glad that he didn't screw up and lose that game, though. I don't think they'll win I don't think they'll get to the 33 games. If they get to 25, I'm happy with that. You know, I'm happy that they got a record at the moment, so I'll take it that. So yeah, that's my thoughts on it.
What do you think was the reason behind, you know, the big deficit? Was it that the team was just tired? Did they come in being complacent, considering, you know, how much decimated the Cavaliers roster was? What do you think got the Heat to be down by 27 in the third?
It could have been a bit of a... I didn't get to see the entire game. I missed a lot of the first half in that, so... I didn't get to see the entire thing to sort of see how they were playing and that. It could have been a motivation factor, like maybe they thought, you know, they had this game in the bag so easy. I'm not sure. I'll need to see the entire game to get a better idea and give you a better answer on that. So, but hopefully it's a good wake up call to them, not to fall so behind into such a solid Dweller team. So yeah, I'm sorry I can't give a better answer than that because I hadn't seen the entire game. So,
well, the incredibly generic answer that I'll offer is that sometimes that's just the way it goes. I mean, we know that any NBA team is in theory capable of beating another, because we do see top teams lose to the lesser teams, and the Cavs are obviously a bit of extra determination there, perhaps given the history with LeBron. And maybe the Heat were complacent. Maybe they just came out, and that's just the way it was. That the shots weren't falling. The Cavaliers had the game going. They got to the second half. The Heat turned it on. The Cavs don't have the talent normally to hang with the Heat, and let alone when they're depleted as they are. So they couldn't withstand the charge. But as far as they had that
nothing to lose mentality. Which can be dangerous.
Yeah.
It can take others by surprise. It's like fuck it, we'll just go out and do what we best we can and go from there. And then they could have a night where things just sort of click in that. So, yeah. That's always going to be an X factor. So,
absolutely. As far as the streak coming to an end, a conventional wisdom says it'll be a team like the Spurs that does it, probably obviously being the best equipped to end the streak. But Murphy's Law says it's going to be someone like the Bobcats. Well, actually, maybe Murphy's Law wouldn't say that. That might even be beyond that twisted logic. But, I know Leftos is not happy that I threw out the suggestion that the Cavaliers might win the game. Even though I didn't believe it. I picked the Heat in the daily predictions thread in the NBA and Basketball Talk. I didn't see them winning. And I thought, okay, so the jinx has gone that way. Clearly, picking them in the thread has ensured a Cavs victory. But no, clearly, even mentioning the possibility turned it around. So it's clearly it's not the you know, throw out that generic answer. It's not the way it goes. It's not complacency by the Heat. It's not anything the Cavaliers did. It's me. It's all me. And yeah, I'm sorry.
Send your complaints to.
Yeah.
Android NBA. Just stop predicting. Just stop hoping for anything that's going to be, you know, that's going to make me happy. Just stop predicting anything. You know, if you see the Pistons winning ever in the next 5 years, just stop hoping that they reach the playoffs. Hope for them to just, you know, I don't know, get the 15th place in the conference or whatever. Get the 18th place in the conference out of 15. I don't know. Just, you know, stop. Your wishful thinking. You're doing nobody a favor, you know, besides Heat fans, maybe. Can you start publicly wishing that the Heat win the championship, please?
Oh, yeah, they're definitely going to win this year. So.
Okay. Yes! Yes! Yes, the jinx is there! Suck it, Heat! Okay. My day is complete. Now I can happily go off. But yeah, we still have a podcast to go through. Anyway, next on the docket, Bynum is still injured. And the 76ers, I bet, are pretty happy about this, along with all their fans. Thoughts?
Well, we saw this coming, didn't we? I mean,
yeah.
The return date kept getting pushed back, and he keeps saying that the knees are feeling good, he's coming back, and then, oh no, the knees are feeling... been bad, and now he's having surgery on not one but both of his knees, so he's going to be out until next season, which means he's going into this off-season as a free agent, coming off a rather large contract, which he earned rather easily, or didn't earn this past year, obviously, having set it out all of it. And the question is, do you see anyone being stupid enough to give him a maximum contract?
No.
Ben?
No.
Even with the ridiculous contracts we've seen, I mean that's the only thing that makes me think it could happen. Is we have seen some pretty bad contracts, and he's not a proven franchise player. He had a pretty good season last year, an all-star season in his last year with the Lakers before he was traded, and he was actually healthy. He actually played in every game for I think the first time since his rookie year or his second year, something like that.
I could probably.
But he's not proven, and he's obviously injured. So I don't know. I surely with the new luxury tax rules, people are going to be looking at it, tightening their belts, and saying, "Well, you know what? Let's not give this guy a maximum deal." Certainly, there's going to be interest. I think you've got to at least have interest, given what he's been able to do when he's healthy. But a maximum deal, I think they're only bidding against yourself if you're offering him that kind of money.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised if who was the Lakers bus player that, or owner that drafted him? It wasn't Jerry. It was his son, wasn't it?
Jim Buss is a big
Jim Buss. Yeah, I could see him probably wanting him drawing back. You know, because that was his boy. You know, he was. Well, you got to remember, will Dwight Howard stay in L.A.?
That's true. But how do they sign Bynum? Because even if Howard's contract comes off the books, the Lakers don't have the cap space. It would have to be a sign and trade, so they'd have to give up someone like Gasol or Kobe.
Yeah, they'll probably give up Gasol.
Seriously? That's your prediction? Lakers giving up Gasol?
Well, they've been wanting to get rid of him for like 2 years.
It's not my prediction. I'd say that's what they'd have to do to get Bynum, because they can't sign him outright.
Why would they get Bynum, though?
Because Jim Buss loves him. He loves him a long time.
Yeah, okay.
That was his pick. That was his boy. He was so proud of that pick. And he...
Even so, who's going to give the Lakers enough of a warranty for their money, because they're obviously going to spend a lot of money on other players, who's going to give them, you know, enough of a warranty for their money that Bynum is even going to, you know, make good use of the money he's going to be paid, other than, you know, hospital bills?
Bowling balls aren't cheap.
Yeah.
I'm seriously not
cheaper than mopeds, though.
I can't be, you know, I can't be sure how, you know, how much it's his fault that he's so badly injured, but, you know, more often than not, it's not the player's fault. So I'm not hating on Bynum. I'm just saying that it makes no sense for a team to pay so much money and to give up on an active player that produces, you know, to get someone that's so big of a risk. But, you know, again,
it's LA,
I don't like the Lakers
that
much.
Over there, so.
I don't like the Lakers that much. Let them make the wrong move and let another team get Gasol and have him, you know, at the proper position producing the proper amount. Because I like Gasol, you know. He's one of the guys that doesn't cause any trouble, that is always, you know, surrounded by people with such big egos. And, you know, he's always left out of the spotlight, but I know he can produce in the right system and in the right team, and he can produce big. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Yeah, but he wasn't with Kobe in the gym.
Yeah, okay, fine. Let the Lakers do what's worst for them. I don't care. I wouldn't mind seeing the Lakers go downhill. Seriously.
Yeah, well, I'm on the same boat. I want them to fuck themselves over, so.
Okay, fine. So, okay, Lakers, please give up Gasol. Get him to a team that can make proper use of him and get Bynum and get nothing out of Bynum. Okay. And any other comments on the subject?
I
think that's pretty much it. I mean, he's going to be out. The Sixers, well, from the Sixers' point of view, I mean, where do they go now? They were doing decently in recent years with Iguodala, who's now got to be really enjoying his time with the Nuggets because they're streaking as well. We talked about the Heat streak. The Nuggets now also won 13 of their own in a row. So Iguodala's got to be loving that move out of there. Yeah, so that I guess the Sixers...
But still, Iguodala is still, you know, if I'm not mistaken, Iguodala is still looking towards free agency this year. So he has to be happy, but how happy is he actually, you know? Is he looking to get to a contender?
Well, if my career is anything to go by, he'll actually leave the Nuggets even if they win a championship. So,
yeah.
There's some great logic there. That's okay, yeah. Now I'm the starting shooting guard, so...
In my career, Iguodala went to the Atlanta Hawks. And oddly... Yeah, and Kevin Garnett went to, who was it? He went to Phoenix.
No, of all the teams to waive the no-trade clause to.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so talking about the Lakers, Kobe's down since the last time we talked. He has been playing through the pain and joining the Lakers.
He played minutes of one game.
Okay. But he didn't produce enough. But still, the Lakers still have managed to find a way to, I think, win 2 out of 3 games since Kobe went down.
One out of the 2 so far.
One out of the 2. Okay. So the Pacers game was the one he got injured in?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Makes sense. We still have to. Is there any news on how long he's going to be out? If he's going to still be trying to play through the pain, or if he's going to stay out for a little while? Because the Lakers definitely need him. You know, there's been discussion on how much do the Celtics actually miss Rondo and. And stuff like that, you know, people that have dropped with injury, and the teams aren't seeming to do any worse without them, although we don't know how well they would play if they still had them. So I don't see how, you know, how that discussion is actually that valid. But anyway, I don't think the Lakers, you know, are a team that can pretty much, you know, do just as fine without Kobe. So they really needed him for this stretch, considering they're so close to, you know, they're right there on the shifting between the 8th and 7th seed, and still there is time if they, you know, drop a few games to drop out of playoff contention. So how do you see this playing out? Do you see the Lakers rushing Kobe back just to make sure they get to the playoffs and risking, you know, something that could be maybe, you know, end his career? Or do you see Kobe staying out for a while and letting the Lakers play without him no matter what happens?
Well, there could be the Kobe stubborn factor, like his stubbornness to get back out on the court.
Yeah.
That could be a contributing factor.
And definitely, you know, the Lakers in the first year that they've had Kobe and Nash and Howard in the same team, it would be, you know, so embarrassing not to enter the playoffs after all, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just a quick correction. The game he actually was injured in was against the Hawks, the loss of the Hawks. They won.
So they were 2 of 3.
They've won 2 of the last 3. The last 2 with him absolutely not playing at all. They won the Pacers game after he played 12 scoreless minutes in the first quarter and then sat out the rest of the way. So yeah, 2 of the last 3, 1 of 2 with him completely absent. So that's,
yeah, but the second game was against the.
Was against the Kings.
Okay, and so
then they lost.
Yeah, not much to be proud of there.
Yeah, then they lost to the Suns in Phoenix, 99-76. And I'm just reading here that Kobe's likely to return to action Friday, which will be against the Wizards.
What was the official call on his injury? What was the description of the injury?
Sprained ankle.
Sprained ankle. So do you think he's rushing back because of the stubbornness factor and because, you know, the Lakers could not be able to afford to lose the playoffs, or do you think that he's actually been cleared to play?
I'm guessing he's probably got clearance. It may not be the best idea. It would look like a pretty nasty sprain. He came down quite badly on Dante Jones. And, of course, that was the controversy with Kobe claiming it was dirty and Lakers everywhere picking up. Oh, I'm still not sure about that. I mean,
yeah, no. No, I'm with you on that. I don't see it being as a deliberate play by Jones in order to, you know, get Brian to fall awkwardly. You know, there was nothing, you know, Atlanta had nothing to win if they saw Kobe fall so terribly so late in the game, you know?
Yeah.
Unless they have 3 games still against the Lakers. You know, they don't have anything to win out of the Lakers losing Brian so badly. And Jones, I don't think that Jones would make a play so dirty. From what's in the replay, I'm just seeing, you know, Jones jumping towards Brian to do his best to defend him during the fadeaway. And he's moving forward more than Kobe's moving backward. So Kobe ends up falling right on Jones's foot.
Yeah.
And it all happened so quickly that I don't see the argument that Jones should have just moved out of the way. You know, when you're defending, you're not in the mindset. You know, you're not thinking, okay, where is he going to fall? Am I in the way? Just defending the player.
He's jumping towards him. He can't move out of the way. He can't stop in midair and move backwards.
Yeah, it's not NBA 2K4. No, just move the stick the other way, and momentum has nothing to do with it. The player would just move the other way, you know.
But I mean, as far as the question, should Kobe have gone to the line and shot free throws coming down on his foot? I don't know. I mean, is that the rule? If you accidentally come down on someone's foot after you've attempted the shot, it's not like they're. It's a bit different to actually clipping a shooter.
I don't think that anything in Jones's guarding Brian warranted a foul.
Yeah.
And what would be the call, you know, of Brian falling on Jones, you know, a completely separate foul, you know? I don't know. You know, tripping or something? Reaching foul with the foot. I don't know. I really don't know. And considering that, you know, is the rule that Bryant has that space because he's falling toward that space when Jones's foot is already there?
Because he's Kobe Bryant.
If it is the rule that the space to in which the player will land is protected and nobody should, you know, affect that, then fine, you know, just bring up the rule and I'll say, okay, fine, I'm fine with it. But I'm not aware of such a rule, you know.
Yeah.
Jones's foot was already there. It didn't seem deliberate as many times as I've watched. It didn't seem deliberate that he planned to put his foot there to make sure Brian fell awkwardly. I see nothing for the Hawks or Jones to gain out of, you know, Brian hurting himself. So I am saying that it was just an honest mistake and that it wasn't a dirty play.
Yeah. I had a why did I scroll down moment, actually, when I was reading about the injury and got to the comments section of the news article.
Which
is always. And I saw this one that someone said, you know, I love Michael Jordan, but he just got all the calls. Kobe Bryant never gets any calls. And I'm like, Kobe Bryant never gets any calls.
Yeah, you know? that deserves the hashtag Sit Magic Johnson says. What was the post I retweeted? I saw a post on Twitter that I retweeted with that hashtag, Sit Magic Johnson says. I need to find it.
Speaking of Shit Magic Johnson says, I actually tweeted him, did not get a response, not surprisingly, but he in a Warriors game the other day, or before a Warriors game, he sat there in the studio and talked about how Bill Simmons was wrong to say Bogut did not impact the game defensively because he was not a shot blocker. Now, he's not the greatest shot blocker in the league, but he has a career average of 1.6. He led the league in 2011 and has averaged over 2 blocks a game for 3 out of the last 4 seasons. And Magic Johnson sits there and says he is not a shot blocker. Does the man know a thing about what's going on? He is one of the all-time.
It's on the same level as Barkley commentating on the 30 teams of the NBA, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, Magic Johnson, great basketball mind, great talent, one of the best ever, and a lot of charisma.
At some point, you have to focus on your family and give up commenting and stuff, well, you know? Just find a new hobby.
He just doesn't
Go play some baseball.
Yeah.
Do it like Jordan.
Welcome to Dodgers baseball.
Yeah. So the tweet I found was from a humoristic account, at not Bill Walton.
That's a classic Twitter.
Yeah, and the tweet was, Heat's 22-game streak is the second most impressive this year after Lakers' early season 36-game moral victory streak.
Yeah.
And then I tweeted that with Sid Magic Johnson says, you know, just because it was so funny to me, you know. It's not that amazing if you know the Lakers won those 36 game morally. So what else? So we're all saying that we're seeing Kobe Bryant doing his best to rush his coming back.
Oh yes.
And helping the Lakers.
You said, was it a good idea, bad idea? I mean, I'm guessing he's been cleared, so medically speaking, it can't be too bad an idea. It looked like a pretty nasty sprain, though, so you'd think they'd maybe taking a couple of extra games off while they are playing some of these weaker opponents, like the Wizards, or the Suns they lost to in Phoenix, so perhaps not the best example. But on paper, at least, they've got a decent schedule that if you needed to miss a couple of games, now an opportune time before it really comes down to the crunch. But watching some of his, for lack of a better word, highlights in the 12 minutes against the Pacers, he just had no lift, obviously, with the ankle injury. No lift on his jump shot. Just was not helping them. And I think they scored 16 first quarter points when he was in the game. So, which is
more a liability.
Yeah. If long term, if he comes back against the Wizards and re-injures that ankle, then you know what's that achieved. So, I guess only he knows how good it is. He's obviously getting the best treatment available, given that he is a professional athlete and all. And again, he knows his limitations, I suppose. And if he wants to do it, well, I guess no one's going to stop him. But I've rolled ankles before playing basketball and. Sometimes taking that extra week off so that you don't cause yourself serious harm, which obviously has huge ramifications with the regular season winding down and such a tenuous hold on that eighth spot. Yeah, we'll see, I guess. But is it stubbornness? I think it's got to be, at least to a certain extent.
Yeah. So moving on, Royce White.
Oh, speaking of stubbornness.
Okay.
Yeah,
but don't go there. Don't go there.
Great
I mean, with all that we've said, that Royce White isn't doing any good to his cause. You don't know how, you know, deliberate these things are, or maybe, you know, how much he's affected by the actual illness that is afflicting him. So I don't want to be too hard on him, you know, if I may. I still believe that even with his latest, you know, even with the latest chapter in this whole saga, he's not doing his cause any favors. And what happened was he went out and pretty much said that the NBA and the Rockets want him gone. So the quotes are from a video interview with the Huffington Post. White, who was recently assigned to the Rockets D-League affiliate, explained his reason in citing his independent voice and the inefficiency of properly treating players with mental health conditions. So, quote, "I went through the bumps and bruises of having to advocate for myself against a billion-dollar corporation. Other than that, I think I've actually been successful if you look at the rate of success or what could have went wrong. I could have easily been out of the league or blackballed or things like that. But that hasn't happened yet. I'm a problem because I'm not afraid to say what I think and I'm not afraid to stand alone. Even amongst the NBA community, the players, the union, the NBA office, and David Stern and Adam Silver, I'm not afraid to stand alone in my own circle and say, hey, listen, you guys aren't respecting mental health. If I was to make an educated guess, I would guess that Adam Silver and David Stern and the Rockets organization, some other owners in the league, GMs, want me gone. And why do they want me gone? Because business is about convenience. It's not about doing what's necessary, right? It's about cutting overhead, being efficient, and a lot of times what's best for us as human beings doesn't meet that criteria for business people." And I have to agree on some levels, you know, considering, you know, business strategies and all, and we still, you know, I still have to take, and I have to stay a bit away from the subject, as we don't know the exact details of everything that went down. You know, we were saying that last time we were discussing Royce White, that without all the details of what happened, you know, exactly what Royce White did, exactly how the Rockets team handled him, how they treated him, if they actually put, you know, the proper professionals on him or whatever, you know, we can't know who's on the wrong and who's on the right. So all I'm saying from this is that the saga continues, and Royce White, for whatever reason, is going out of his way to say the NBA wants him gone, which seems far-fetched, but again, I can't really know for sure what's going on. I don't see, you know, him saying things like that, helping his cause, and we talked about last week about how it's a great move from, I think it was the Mavericks,
yes,
who signed, yeah, who signed the first player with a mess, and how much of a feel-good story that is. But, you know, it still remains to be seen how that turns out as well. And we don't know all the details. So, yeah, Royce White isn't doing himself any favors, but still, you know, you don't know how much of the stuff he says are pure truth, how much of the stuff he says is pure lies, or how much of the stuff he says, you know, are just, you know, stuff that are coming out of him because of the stress that his mental illness, his mental affliction is causing him. So I'm going to take a neutral stance on this and say that it's not good for him what's happening, but, you know, I can't know what is actually going on.
Fair enough. I mean, I can see that. And we don't know what's going on. We don't know the extent of the of his illnesses. And clearly he does have a few issues. I think that's fair to say. I just don't like the whole idea of it's immediately has to be the big billion-dollar corporation's fault. I mean, as you said it, he's not doing himself any favors, portraying himself as a martyr and a victim. I think that's the absolute wrong way to go about the cause, always pointing fingers at the other people. I'm doing everything. Are you? You pretty much refuse to do anything the Rockets say, it seems, unless it's on his terms. Now, if it is coming from him, from his illness, then we can give him a pass on that and take a neutral stance, that's fine. But here's what I'll say about the people handling, you know, him, for lack of a better word, the people around him giving him advice and whatnot. They are doing a terrible job because he's not doing himself any favors. And these are the people who should be pulling him aside and saying, look, you know, we've got to play this smart. We've got to, you know, you certainly fight for your rights, but do it in a way that's not going to alienate the people you want to get on your side and actually
come back and bite
come to a resolution.
Ass.
I mean, does he want to get into the NBA and earn his spot just the way same way everybody else did, or is he just trying to make the NBA to make a point about to campaign for his mental health issues? Because if he wants to campaign for mental health issues, that's fantastic. We need more people doing that. But the NBA is not necessarily the platform to do it. The NBA is a platform for people to play professional basketball. And if he's not going to meet the responsibilities of an NBA player, you know, how much slack can the Rockets give him? That's how I feel. It's just, yeah, we should be sympathetic, and I am sympathetic, but at the same time, silence is golden, I think. I think this needs to be worked out behind closed doors, calmly, professionally, with understanding on both sides. And I don't know how close how far the Rockets have been willing to go to meet him halfway on this, but from the way he's talking, I don't know whether he or the people who are making his decisions for him or advising him on his decisions, how willing they are to meet the Rockets halfway. So I don't know. Just when you think that the story might have a happy ending, there's another twist in the road. So,
you know, for all we know, though, you know, it could be either side, you know, being completely right or something in the middle. It could be that Royce White has been lying from day one and has just been begging for attention. Royce White is, you know, is being afflicted by his illness and he's making all those comments and nobody's there, you know, to protect him. Or that he's telling the absolute truth and that he should be coming out with all this information because he's actually, you know, being silently forced out of the league. And without all the proper information, we have no idea what is actually going on. And that's the most frustrating thing for me. Because maybe, you know, just maybe he actually needs help. He actually needs some proper people or organizations or lawyers to support him, and he doesn't have the proper support because nobody has the proper information, and it's easy to assume that he's exaggerating, you know?
Yeah.
But we have no idea on that whole spectrum of what is actually the truth. We have no idea where the needle of reality actually is. You know, that's the most confusing and frustrating thing about discussing this. And I really don't see, you know, I really don't like when people that don't have all the information take an absolute side saying, oh, he's absolutely exaggerating, the Rockets organization would never do something like that. How do you know? How do you know if you're not part of the Rockets organization and if you're part of the Rockets organization and you're not under an agreement not to say anything bad about it or you're going to lose your job, you know, how do you know that that's actually the case?
Well, I think because he's taken such an extreme view of, oh, this almost, I don't know if he's actually used the word conspiracy. Did he use the word conspiracy or at least imply it? But
no, I don't know.
Maybe he stopped short of that, but he's taken such a hardline, extreme approach to, you know, it's all their fault, that you do start to wonder, well, that is a very one-sided story. And I think that's perhaps what's has people more sympathetic to the Rockets than they normally would be.
Yeah.
Which is
weird,
because normally when it comes down to a player and a team and the treatment, people tend to go with the little guy, the individual, the player. But again, because he has taken that such a vocal standpoint on the whole issue, and it has come across as so one-sided because the Rockets are sort of playing it, you know, with the occasional press release and whatnot, they I think come off as the more sympathetic party to a lot of people because his comments haven't done him any favors, and which is unfortunate if indeed the truth is somewhere in the middle, which I can see. I mean, we have to be careful of subscribing to the golden mean fallacy. But at the same time, there are a lot of the cases the truth is somewhere in the middle, and that's probably the case here, that maybe the Rockets could be, maybe they're not meeting the requirements, and they obviously went in knowing that he had these issues because they've been there since college. So maybe they haven't taken all the steps they can, and maybe he hasn't done all he can. But hopefully they do. Hopefully they can get it sorted out. I mean, that's and not just for their future, but also his as well, because if he has these issues and he's fighting this battle in a bad way, then you don't want to see him become a twisted, bitter, angry young man, because we've...
Yeah.
So...
Anyway, yeah. We'll see how this story develops. I doubt this is the last chapter on, you know, the whole saga. So we'll see how this goes on, and if, you know, at some point we find out more details about what's actually happening behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Okay, so anything else out of the NBA that you'd... LeBron's dunk on Jason Terry. So, okay. Yeah. So, apparently, knighted is now a verb. A gerund, at least, you know? No, not a gerund, whatever it's called. Anyway, people, so apparently you can knight someone, and it's such a... The thing I love about this the most is that Brandon Knight had such an unfortunate yet such fitting last name.
Yeah.
About, you know, knighting a person, making someone a knight, because that's actually a verb.
Yes.
It was basketball gods or fate working.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, the sensational dunk of the week this week was LeBron's dunk on Jason Terry. And are we still going to discuss this? Seriously?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. It was awesome. The one thing I do want to say, looking at Yahoo NBA today, they had an article on there how LeBron is reveling after the dunk and saying that it was, you know, I felt good doing that and embarrassing him and everything. And I just thought back to last week with Adrian Wojnarowski posting that article about how it was so backwards and everything. And his latest is something praising LeBron for his performance and taking over that game. And I'm thinking, so one minute you're saying this is focusing on this is the wrong and back up to her. Again, another watch flip flop. I shouldn't be disappointed because we've come to expect it, but I just thought it was funny that how we approach these things so differently. Bottom line, both dunks were awesome, and they should be enjoyed. They're both top 10 dunks of the year, and I can watch them again and again.
Yeah,
I know the fact that it was LeBron dunking on a smaller man and that, but the LeBron's one, it was more front on towards him. It wasn't like the DeAndre Jordan one where he's basically his other arm and even the sort of side of his body acting as a guard in a sense to try and prevent the contact. So it was more, LeBron's one was more direct on with the arm that was holding the ball at the time to attack the rim. I think that one, in a sense, can give it a slight a boost in some way, even though, yes, it was against a smaller man and player. But you do have to ask the question, what the hell was Jet thinking?
Yeah. Well, let's give him credit. He stood there trying to take a charge. You know, he made a defensive effort. That's what counts.
No, he jumped. He jumped into it. He didn't try and take the charge. He jumped into it.
Okay. I watched it again, clearly. Any excuse to watch it again.
Yeah. And, so you sort of have to question, and it sort of brings back memories of the one again where LeBron dunked on Damon Jones a few years ago and that. But this one was just a little bit more brutal with the body being slammed on the ground. And I think it helped Jason Terry's cause when he sort of slightly rolled over a little bit when LeBron started the little taunt standing over thing. I mean, I know Jet was rolling over to sort of get help from his teammate and all that to help him get off his feet. But the whole timing from when LeBron was taunting and that little rollover, it almost like it was sort of cowering into like the fetal position and stuff like that. So just the sort of timing of the roll and the standing over him sort of thing was just...
Added to the dramatics of the whole thing.
Made it more comical in some sense. Like, you just made me your bitch sort of scenario. don't hurt me anymore. Sort of thing. But
the bottom line is we enjoyed it even if the internet didn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that enough? I'm tired of talking about dunks, you know. It's not that important. It happens every week. Some are going to be more impressive than others. and we're still making such a huge fuss about.
Until you dunk on someone, then you'll know.
Yeah, I know, I know.
That's never going to happen
unless I find the girl that John blocked, and I get a 7-foot rim. There's no way that I could ever dunk on anybody in my life.
Well, if you came over to my side of the world, there is a ring that me and my friends have made which has adjustable height where you could actually dunk it, and it's freaking solid as hell. So we've had 3 people hang on it, and 2 of these people were over 100 kilos each, and the other was about 70 to 80 kilos. So, yeah.
So they were fluffy.
I just want to point out, last week left us, you were making the argument that it's not just 2 points. So you've enjoyed dunks as well. You know, let's.
I wasn't saying that it's not just 2 points. That wasn't my argument. I was saying that, you know, maybe in North Korea basketball, that's the rule. I was reading about the... I don't know if that was a humoristic article or something, but I was reading about how basketball has different rules in North Korea. I'm going to look it up while we're moving on. So
one thing I'll throw out there is something I caught after the Mavericks Nets game today, an ESPN 30 for 30 documentary on Benjamin Wilson, Benji Wilson. Are either of you guys familiar with it?
No.
Oh, he was a player, a high school prospect from Chicago in 1984, very highly touted. The first Chicago-born player to be ranked number one in the country as he was preparing for high school. He was a friend and a teammate of Nick Anderson, and grew up playing with Tim Hardaway and the other guys from Chicago who were growing up in Chicago at the time. But he was shot in an argument outside a store and killed at 17. And another basketball tragedy before, much like Len Bias, his career over before it ever really got started. Very sad story. But it was a very good documentary on the whole situation. Might be on YouTube or one of the other video sites, but otherwise, or some video on demand service. But ESPN 30 for 30 Benji, if anyone wants to check it out. It's definitely worth having a look at those documentaries.
It's the story that reminds me of that. Remember that Kelly Rowland song, Stole?
No.
Or Stolen or something? It mentions about this high school prospect, and you know, he's about, I think the next day he's about to go train with the 76ers and that, but he gets shot. So it's about sort of stealing a generation and that. And yeah, I remember me and my mates, you know, we always just sort of get all teary-eyed, sort of sad hearing that sort of line in the song. I'll send you a link to it and all that. You know, this kid had all this potential prospect. But yeah, he gets shot and killed just before going to train and play against AI and all that stuff. So little sad little moment in the song just because of the whole basketball connection.
Absolutely.
So I looked it up, and actually it's not verified, but I'm reading that in North Korea, Chinese media have reported that the country has North Korea has developed its own scoring system: 3 points for a dunk, 4 points for a three-pointer that does not touch the rim, 8 points for a basket scored in the final 3 seconds, and -1 point. For any missed free throws. That's an interesting take.
Yeah.
You know? For all the criticism, that would make for some great... And I'm not saying the official NBA should should implement this, but, you know, any unofficial league that had such rules would make the games even more interesting.
It's like that slam ball where they had the trampoline. Yeah, it's like a hybrid version of that, in a sense.
Imagine, you know, being up by 1 point and missing 2 free throws in the last seconds.
Yeah. Well, you know,
and losing the game.
I don't know if you'd make it to the locker room alive. I think the dictating leader would probably shoot you or have you assassinated before you even made it to that locker room.
You know, but then, you know, missed free throws, because most probably you will see centers missing free throws. Missed free throws are then, you know, made up for with the additional point on every dunk. So even though centers would be very much eligible for hack and send to the line, you know, Shaquille O'Neal and Andre Drummond and people that are so bad at free throws would get to the line constantly, but they'd have an even bigger incentive to make it up for themselves by dunking all the game long, which would make for more impressive games.
JaVale McGee would lead the league in scoring.
But if you took a point away for every missed dunk, I don't see him leading. You know, there's a thing in baseball, I'm not sure if you guys are aware, where they're also counting errors. I'm not that familiar with the rules to know what consists of an error, but if we counted errors in the, you know, in basketball for, you know, ridiculous turnovers, it would be completely subjective, but, you know, JaVale McGee would be top in the list. For ridiculous plays or ridiculous errors, you know, and took a point away, it would make it such a better game, you know? So, moving on. I think we're done with the NBA discussion.
Yeah. That's about all for this week, I'd say, yeah.
Yeah. Should we move on to other stuff?
Certainly.
Okay, so there is something that happened. I was reading about it last night. There's the... I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with the Python programming language. There's a conference that takes place every year that gathers, you know, Python developers and companies that make use of Python in a big event. And this year's PyCon, as it's called, the Python conference, there was an incident. As there was a presentation going, some guys in the crowd starting, you know, making jokes between themselves. You know, there were guys that were there representing their companies, and their companies were sponsors of the conference, just to give you some context. And they started joking. Between the developers, there's a few words, you know, that sound silly, but they have actual meaning when you're a developer. For example, there's forking, where a fork is if I put up some code on the internet and you want to work on that code without affecting my code, you know, you make a copy of that code, and that's called forking, you know, and you have my project as a copy of your own, and you can make changes and then send me those changes back. I've actually discussed this. That's how 211 actually, you know, pushed his changes, his improvements to roster editor back to me. You say to the developer, here is my fork, I've made those changes, do you want them to be in the official release? So there's forking, and then there's dongle, which is one of the silliest words of all time, you know.
I know it as a device that plugs into a.
Yeah, it's a small piece of hardware.
Yeah,
you know, there's dongles that you plug to your computer. When television went from analog to digital, you needed some kind of dongle if you didn't want a whole device. You see, you're laughing already.
Yeah.
You needed some kind of dongle if you didn't want to get a whole decoder device. I have such a dongle on my TV because there's no space where the TV is to put a whole, you know, full-fledged decoder. So I have just that, a small device that's hidden behind the TV. It connects directly on the TV, takes up no space at all. So yeah, that's the two offending words. Fork and dongle. So these guys were there in the Python conference, and during a presentation, they started joking between themselves about forking and big dongles. You know, they weren't directing those comments to the presenter. They weren't directing them to anybody. They were just joking between themselves. Granted, it was a professional conference, and they were wearing the badges of their companies who were sponsors of the conference. So they should be behaving properly, right? Can we agree on that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
So what happened, though, is that a female attendant, a female developer that was sitting a row ahead of them, was offended by the jokes they were making, which is, you know, it's to be expected. So, but not all people are going to take your jokes lightly, especially if they're sexual.
Sure.
They weren't being directed at her, but she was still offended. Oh, I'm fine with that, you know. The proper thing to do would be for her to, you know, turn around and say, can you stop joking about that stuff? You know, you're making me feel uncomfortable. And if the guys kept joking, of course, you know, you would escalate. Maybe, you know, there is the code of conduct that says, or of the Python conference that says that, you know, improper behavior, you know, should be reported. So if you're feeling uncomfortable because someone is making dirty jokes, you know, you should, if they escalate, you can, if they ignore your pleads to stop, you can, of course, report them to the Python conference organization team. But that certain female attendant decided to escalate before she confronted them. They were just sitting a row behind her, and her justification was that she didn't want to be heckled by them, by telling them to stop, and she didn't want her experience to be denied. I'm not sure what that means. My English are failing me. So she didn't confront the guys. Instead, what she did was take a photo of them and post it on Twitter, on her public Twitter stream.
Right.
And after that, she started tweeting the Python conference organization team by pointing the team to the tweet that had the photo of those guys, saying that those guys are behaving inappropriately according to the code of conduct of the conference. So the Python conference team tweeted back after a while saying, thank you for reporting the incident, we've taken care of it. And actually, one of the guys ended up being fired by his company. Because they deemed that inappropriate behavior in the conference, and after all the things that happened, how it went public, and since that person was wearing the company's badge, and he was now exposed to everyone to see, with that photo being published, the company didn't want to have anything to do with a guy making that joke, and so they fired him. At least it's been reported that he was fired. You know, you can know for sure, you know, unless that person actually comes out and says it. I'm not sure if he's actually come out or whatever the story is.
Yeah.
So, that escalated quickly, is all I can say. But I wanted to ask your opinion on this. And I meant to put a thread up in the forums, but I was reading late last night before I went to sleep, so it's all the better that we're discussing this on the podcast and then put it up in the forums, you know, for everyone to discuss. Do you think that she acted the right way, or do you think that she should have confronted them first and avoid, you know, the public humiliation if that was possible? Do you think that the risk of being heckled is enough to post the photo of the people that were making those jokes between themselves on Twitter and, you know, publicly shame them for it? Andrew?
I mean, there's part of me that likes the whole vigilante justice of the whole thing. And certainly if they were behaving inappropriately, making her feel uncomfortable, whatever. And there's some very interesting laws when it comes to sexual harassment in Western society that depends where you are in the world, but a lot of it does come down to, even if somebody is made uncomfortable by a joke or feels that they are in a position where they've got to put up with something that's bothering them and offending them, that can count as harassment. It does seem a little extreme. I mean, to cost someone, to get someone to demand their job, or even if she didn't ask.
She didn't. Just to be clear, she didn't ask.
She didn't? Okay.
You could say that their actions, which led to her actions, led to the people being fired, to that person being fired. So
I don't know the whole
on the first stage of the whole thing, the people that made the jokes are to blame for making those jokes under company badge and in a public conference. But as you know, as another attendee, or as a as a third party completely, do you want to see someone be fired for making a joke with some friends of his in a conference
that was overheard by somebody else? That's what I kind of find a little bit. The naming and the shaming, the public shaming, and the which led to the directly or indirectly led to it, when you simply could tap someone on the shoulder and say, "Look, shut up," or gone through the appropriate channels, or contacted someone privately. There's a tattletale mentality to that. That I'm not condemning her. Don't get me wrong, because I'm not certainly not saying that harassment is fine, and certainly you should behave yourself in public. So they can't. Their actions can't. We can't say they brought it on themselves. There was a very easy way for them to not get into trouble, and that was to not be giggling like a couple of schoolboys and making inappropriate jokes. It just seems like it's gone a bit too far for them to actually lose their job over it. I'm not a big fan of the public naming and shaming like that. It's a little on the nose as well.
Normally, the process when it comes to things like that, like any form of harassment and all that, usually first step, ask the people to stop. If they refuse, then the next step is a report to the HR department. Then it's HR's department to investigate and come up with a better solution, or whether that be that they do fire them, or they get these guys to amend their ways with like a official apology, depending on how severe the case was. Doing it the public way like that on social media in the end result getting them one of the guys fired because they had the company's logo on it, which I can see would hurt the image and all that stuff. But I think that process where they try and could resolve the issue and make aware of, okay, this person, or there was a comment that was made that was offensive, do the right thing, apologize, and so forth and all that. I think that process could have been implemented. I don't know how...
It just seems like they jumped a few steps.
Yeah.
It seems like they jumped a few steps.
Unless, of course, it was like horrible, like it was so derogatory that basically to the point, like maybe like the KG point where he said to Mello that his wife tastes like Honey Nut Cheerios or whatever it was, if it's something like that extreme and that offensive, I could see the reaction where they could skip a step and all that. But if it's hard to tell with the context, but I think the process should have been maybe tell these guys to shut the fuck up as the reason is that being what they're saying is offensive. If it didn't go to that, or if they refused to, she should have made the comment or the report to HR.
Or the
and
events that way,
exactly, and that way it could go through the proper process that generally most organizations have in place, especially when it comes to sexual harassment. I've had to deal with writing up legislation and policies and procedures for organizations and that. So kind of implementing what I've learned from that, it's like, these processes are there for a reason and should be taken. So that way it doesn't hopefully involve into a scenario that with an overreaction or underreaction. It's their design to try and find and resolve the issue properly in a private manner, because it can be embarrassing on both sides.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, it's kind of coarse to tweet a picture and say, "Oh, look at these idiots."
And in a sense,
she could have, you know, there is a whole. I am actually reading up on the code of conduct of the Python conference, and it has a list of staff, and it clearly says that all conference staff will be wearing conference T-shirt with the word staff on it. Yep. The staff will also be prepared to handle the incident. So there were a lot of ways to go about it. She could have used an email. She could have reached out to any of the staff, do it privately. And there's actually a note in the attendee procedure for handling harassment page of the PyCon saying public shaming can be counterproductive to building a strong community. PyCon does not condone nor participate in such actions out of respect.
But so
she cites the code of conduct so many times in her blog post. So many times. But she avoids that little piece in the writing there.
Isn't that always the way? The one little technicality that proves us wrong is the one that we push aside. I mean, and that's something, again, to stress, she has every right to be offended and to take action.
Yeah. Absolutely, but take it privately.
It's the way she went about it. There's a right way, wrong way to do these things. And
can the situation where she's publicly put these guys' profile out there, you know, can that be defamation. I mean, yeah, they've done something wrong and all that, but with that information out publicly for what could have been like a minor offensive joke. You know, these guys' can be tarnished more professionally now because of that. So, I mean, the official process should have gone through first, and for a minor thing.
You know, I understand that if that was, you know, a repeated thing, if he was, you know, constantly getting reports of harassment and stuff, that, you know, there would be a point there. But having a joke that you said between friends, you know, if they directed any of the jokes out here, oh, publicly shame them, do everything you want, I wouldn't mind at all, you know. Seriously. If they were hitting up on her or saying, you know, or pointing those jokes out here, I'd love to fork you, baby, or anything like that. Publicly shame them, you know, scream their names out.
Yeah.
Right in the middle of the conference. Yeah. But they're joking amidst themselves. You overheard the joke and you're publicly shaming them, and that's your first point of action.
Yeah, I mean, it could be.
There's
too
a lot more steps, you know. I understand how it was offensive, although I don't find the jokes offensive themselves. But I understand how they might have sounded offensive to her. But she went straight for public shaming.
Yeah.
One thing that the guys could have probably done is maybe gauge the temperature of the rumors regarding some of the things that they're saying. Maybe ask, you know, is anyone sensitive to certain kind of humans? Like, I've been in environments where, especially if you're new to the workplace, and
it's not a workplace though; it's a conference.
But it's still in a workplace-like environment. Maybe engage and sort of get to sort of know if anyone could be offended in before they go on these sort of they go about these jokes and that. When I was training in my courses and that, when I was working for an organization, I always checked, you know, if anyone was offended by swearing or any other issues, just so also the room could engage, like, if another classmate's wearing class kind of thing, you know, would someone find offense to that? So you I suppose that it could have been something that maybe they could have done. I don't want it to sort of be like all entirely one-sided blame, but yeah, you know, there could have been some process the guys who were joking and that could have taken just to make sure that there was no insensitivity and all that stuff. So just, I'm looking at it on both sides, so. Yeah,
I think when it comes down to it, as a society, we just need to try to be respectful of one another. What it comes down to, and when people do offend us, be able to say, "Look, that wasn't on," and then offer the chance for an apology. You know, say, you know, that you offended me, or can you please stop disrupting this? I want to listen to, you know, what the conference is about. Yeah. Instead of these childish jokes. I mean, there's like we said, the steps that were missed. You know, there's social protocol above anything else, let alone code of conduct. I mean, just do we have to learn to interact with each other as a society? I mean, some people might say that the technology has ruined our forms of face-to-face communication because we're so used to texting or Facebooking or whatever that we don't have that proper interaction anymore. And I think we've all maybe had experiences with a friend or an acquaintance that
have we all become socially inept with throughout technology.
I don't want to blame technology because technology is great, and I think anyone
I think it's too much of a scapegoat excuse. You know, it's like the whole video games and violence sort of thing.
Absolutely, it may have contributed to it, but I think it would still be there without technology. You know, we just human nature can be rather unpleasant at times, and sometimes we just all need to just think about someone else and think about how our actions impact other people, and just treat each other respectfully, and just take a moment and think before we act, and think: I really need to cost someone their job, or do I need to publicly shame them, or can I just say, "Hey, shut up"? Either say, just shut up, you're bothering me, you know, settle down, or at the same time, do people really need to hear me and my friends talking like a couple of high school kids, sniggering over jokes?
I'll sort of bring up a somewhat of a comparison, like those two Australian radio broadcasters that did that prank call to the hospital that Kate Middleton and all that was in because she was, what was she having? It was like morning sickness and stuff like that. You know, that was an unfortunate accident, in my opinion. And again, you know, gauging the sort of temperature, you know, thinking about the consequences of... I know they probably didn't intend that it would go as far as it did, like being able to get the sort of information that they had. So, you know, it was just like, oh, we'll just see what happens kind of thing. And it went beyond anyone's expectations and control.
It spiraled out of control, yeah.
Yeah.
But there was also controversy about her being bullied at the hospital as well? So she was, and on top of their procedures of giving out confidential information. I mean, it was a mess on both sides.
Yeah.
No one handled it well, so.
No. So, yeah.
Blame all around.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was just one of those unfortunate things, and it could have been a similar thing, like if the process isn't done properly, or, you know, just not thinking of the consequences, or if you're the person who's basically caused the reason for a complaint as such, you know, it could have been an innocent mistake to do it, and not thinking outside yourselves in that sense, and what could have been the dangers or the risks of what you're saying, even though it may have been a harmless joke to some and all that. So, yeah, it can be a bit of an overreaction in a sense to a lot of people. Like we becoming too politically correct, and we losing our abilities to gauge normally without offending everyone kind of thing. So, yeah, it's... Are we going a little step too far in some cases of political correctness?
Yeah.
So, just to wrap up and get my summarized opinion on this, I didn't think that what the guys did was appropriate, and I still don't believe that the way the female attendant, I'm deliberately keeping her name private, but she has a public blog. You can find it out if you look it up. It's not that it's away from the news. I still don't think she handled it properly. You know, there were still a lot of private ways. Even the Python conference code of conduct that she cites so many times in her blog post says that reports are going to be confidential and we're against public shaming, but She loves the code of conduct for protecting her from harassment, but she didn't want to handle it the proper way and go and be private about this. You know? I still think she handled it the wrong way, and it's, you know, it has probably cost those people their careers because they made a joke about, you know, that wasn't even directed at her, between themselves. That, you know, even the jokes weren't sexist or anything, you know. Talking about forking or talking about big dongles, they could be, you know, the guys could be homosexual for all we know. You know, they could all be, you know. You have no idea. They weren't sexist. They were just joking, and they were inappropriate jokes for a conference that has a proper set of rules. But you have to handle these things the proper way, and she didn't handle them the proper way, if you ask me.
It sort of sounds like the whole thing you just talked about, and it sort of reminds me of what the Hartley brothers episode of South Park, you know, with the
to connect everything we talk about, right?
South Park, it's Simpsons or Futurama or Family. But yeah, the whole, I think it was Hartley brothers or something like that, where they go and try and solve the who took a dump in the urinal sort of the Raging Clue, and yeah, it's the, is Kyle responsible for 9/11 and all that stuff? So yeah.
Yeah.
That's what just reminded me of. Just brought back memories of that episode.
Moving on, another news. Valve has announced that she's going to instate a Steam Early Access program. What this means is that it's a similar thing to what I've been discussing about what happened with Trials Evolution. You pre-ordered the game for $20 and you got access to a beta for 2 weeks that started 3 weeks before the game was released. The game actually was playable even the 1 week between the end of the beta and the official release of the game, but without any online capability. So any times you recorded would be kept offline, you couldn't connect with other players online, you couldn't have access to the community sections and everything like that, but you could still play the game offline, even outside of the beta. It wasn't date-locked or anything like that. So Valve wants to instate an official program about this and allow, you know, and give incentives to developers to do things like that. And so you're going to be paying either a full price or an exclusive pre-order price before the games are released, get access to beta versions of the game so that you can help developers that maybe, you know, don't have the resources to have a full-fledged Q&A department, and report, play the beta that's obviously going to have issues, report the issues, and help the developers either get the game out in a good retail state or, you know, have a good early days patch that's going to solve many of the problems, you know. And so that's going to be instated as officially, as an official thing. And Trials Evolution on the PC isn't the only example of this. Minecraft, for example, had people, you know, buying the game while it was still in alpha or beta, you know, by the developers, and still, you know, the people were reporting issues, suggesting features, and the game has grown so much, and you're getting everything that has been in the game since then. Nobody needed to pay again for any of the additional stuff or for any of the fixes.
Uncharted 3 was like that. Like, they did like 3 or 4 months before the game was actually released, they had their multiplayer beta sort of as a way to sort of test.
Multiplayer betas are very common, you know, to stress test the servers, gauge the interest in the game, see if the infrastructure is there. But, you know, we're talking about betas of the full game. Yeah. You know, access to the full game in a beta manner. You know you're paying for the game early. You know you're going to have access to a version of the game that's probably going to be broken in more ways than you'd like, but you're actively helping the developers, you know, squash out any bugs so that the retail experience is better for everyone. And, you know, there's big studios like, you know, maybe EA or Ubisoft or, you know, big publishers that could help the smaller studios have proper Q&A, but it's the smaller developers that would really have an advantage by using a program such as this one. But that's my opinion, guys. Do you see yourselves, you know, buying into this and buying games early, pre-ordering them just to get access to the beta, to get a first taste and actually, you know, try to report bugs? Because that can go either way. I was checking out, of course, I've been raving about Trails Evolution, and I actually checked out the beta, I pre-ordered it to get access to the beta, and I was so pissed off at people entering the forums and complaining about the game's problems. That's the whole point! That's the whole point of the beta. The game is supposed to have issues that you're going to report to the developers in a constructive manner. I was seeing people say, fuck Redlinks, fuck Ubisoft, this game is broken. Yes, obviously. You're not helping.
Yeah, so
this
point.
This is a double-edged sword, because giving people access to a beta, you know, if the people aren't actually, you have to make the people aware of what a beta is. It's not a demo. It's not early access to the full proper game.
Yeah.
It's going to be something that if you buy into, you're going to be actually actively trying to help the developers squash out bugs. So are you willing to buy into that? Or, you know, because if people aren't aware what they're buying into, it could, you know, it could lead to, you know, posts in forums or blog posts saying this game is terrible, it's full of problems, you know, the developers are never going to fix this game and stuff like that. You know, you have to be clear about what you're giving the users. And the internet is stupid. I think we've established that much. Yeah. You know, that the internet is pretty much stupid.
I think you've just got to wade through those stupid comments and just look at the. I mean, don't dismiss.
So
people.
So you agree with the plan? You know, you agree with the initiative like that?
I think it's
like
good. I put $50 down on Pro Wrestling X to support alongside Yao Ming, who's really into it with the modding, as we've talked about before. I like the idea that you put the money down, you make that investment, you can do the beta testing, post these reports, you get the updates for free, and when the full version comes along, you get that, and when the subsequent sequel comes, they're actually giving that as well. Hopefully that all pans out and whatnot. But yeah, I like the idea. And as far as the feedback goes, it's like anything, I suppose, when it comes to the internet. You just have to filter out the comments that are the rubbish. If they're a little bit rude but still constructive, then you can look at it and just sort of tune out the rudeness and take what you can from it. If they are just completely misguided, you move on to the next one. You don't even bother writing it down if it's just saying this game sucks when it's a beta and they actually have no idea. Certainly, you put it up front that. What it is and what you're expecting and what you require of the people playing it. But you can put that on big red letters in size 72 font and some people are still not going to read that.
So
you are going to have to wade through the rubbish, wade through the slime and the muck and actually look at at what the people say. Because usually when people say something really intelligent on the internet, it will stand out. So you look at, that's what you look at, and you just sort of say, well, okay, guys, clearly you've missed the point. Here's the explanation, but if you've got nothing to say, you just look at the people who've got something constructive to say. But I like it. I like it, and I hope that you said that the small developers can benefit from it, and that's true, but certainly so can the larger developers as well. So, yeah, I'd like to see more of it. I think it's a good idea.
Yeah. Anyway, Ben, your thoughts on...
I think it can benefit a lot of developers, especially the small ones. Things like sports games, though, I think because they've got such that tight deadline, and they obviously want to try and keep a lot of secrets in that, so that your competition doesn't steal ideas as such, it wouldn't work so much for them. But definitely the games that are in development for quite a few years, I think that could have... it can benefit them. I was thinking...
Well, for example, but that's NBA Live at the moment. That's a game that's been
developed true.
For a couple of years. Well, so, I mean, that's an example.
The way I've seen, like, with the whole situation that happened with it, you know, especially when they're trying to introduce a physics-based engine, and, you know, that you can't do that shit overnight. Let's be realistic. You can't do that in 1 year.
We've said that before. That's
yeah,
downfall.
It's definitely a 3 year sort of project. What they should have done in a lot of ways is been working on it in the background for 2 years, and sort of on the third year, when they're sort of getting it really sort of fine-tuned, and so that way for when it's all... because I'd imagine they want to keep it more for quite a few years, obviously. Is on that third year, they sort of release it in some way where it may not be entirely finished, but they can gauge feedback from the community from it and say and find out what people don't like about the sort of maybe the control method or what can be improved in it. So that way they can spend that year or even in like when it's a sort of beta process and all that, they can spend that third year in a sense...
really polishing.
Fine-tuning it more to a user-friendly method. So, sorry, it should have been released on the second year when they'd sort of... Yeah, and then on the third, you know, sort of get that in between the second and the third, they get that feedback and they go, all right, we need to sort of maybe fine-tune this a little bit better. So that way, on that third year, it's a lot cleaner. And definitely by fourth year, once it's had a bit more work on it, then everyone will be on the same level. They'll be familiar with what the intent is and that. So that's one process that they should have done. It's sad it didn't happen. Maybe when it comes to future planning for the next sort of iteration, when there could be something more as revolutionary as a physics-based system can be in a sports game and that. So... have that process. I know EA is about making money and trying to save a lot of money. There's no doubt, and that's part of their DNA as such. But it's
well,
better strategy. But EA has that reputation sort of thing. It's like Apple has that reputation for being the money hungry sort of thing aspect. You know, so. But the benefits of doing it in the short term are greater than having to try and play catch up and repair and all that stuff in the long run because the system's failed and all that. So, yeah, you got to look at it in that sense. A bit of short term pain in some way in the cost, but it could have that long term gain where you set yourself up better for the future. So, I think that's one area where it can be good and bad for sports titles in some way.
Yeah, and it's not just sports titles. It's not just because you're doing a beta. It's not a given that you're doing it right. For example, SimCity had a beta, but it only limited players to 1 hour at a time.
Yeah.
So people couldn't go deep enough to notice some of the issues that maybe, you know, they could discourage a lot of people, but it would be very important feedback so that EA could bring patches that fixed a lot of the game's broken aspects as soon as possible. You know, never mind the server issues. I'm talking about things that are broken in the game, for example, pathfinding and... and finding the proper paths when, for example, when two roads are there... And one is completely clogged up but shorter, and the other one is fully empty but longer. For whatever reason, you know, people will always prefer the shorter road, so the pathfinding is limited to what's the shortest distance. You know, and things like that could be so obvious during the beta period and could be easily reported, and EA could start planning to patch them day one, but they didn't do that. You know, they did a beta, but they didn't do it right. And then there's, you know, there's the very limited demos. For example, even your demos can act as betas, and Konami found that out when, I think, last year's Pro Evolution Soccer got a demo out. It had various problems. People reported those problems, but the demo was out a good time before the release. I think it was 2 months or something. So people got the demo, reported many of the issues, and Konami actually released a second demo. It said, we tried and fixed as many of the issues as you reported. How do you like this one?
Yeah.
You know, it was never meant to be a beta, but they paid attention to the people's feedback and actually fixed a lot of the issues. So, but again, you need to give people the proper depth as far as the demo or the beta goes. For example, we loved NBA 2K13, but did we know from the demo that we were going to love it? No.
Of course not.
It was just two teams. It was, what, 2 or 5 minutes? What was
two,
it?
Two-minute
quarters, no substitutions, no play calling, nothing. Yeah. No? We've criticized 2K on its demos time and time again, and they seem to be going through the same strategy for whatever reason. Their demos are crippled and are not at all representative of what to expect. And when the medium is so crippled, you know, people are going to be more frustrated from it, even if the features were there. But you know, I think it's the perfect balance between showing people too much and them realizing that a few things are broken that you have no time to fix. And maybe showing people too little that they have no idea what the game is going to be like and they can give you no proper feedback. But you have to strike the balance, you know. And I think Konami went the right way by providing an early demo that they actually had time. You can limit the demo as much as you want, you know. But they gave the people enough features and enough time to spend on the game. And enough time, they gave enough time themselves as a developer to actually go to the game code, fix the issues before the game went gold. Or even, you know, I wouldn't mind if the game went gold with those issues, as long as the publisher said your feedback was very important and we're going to have a patch in the first week or the first 2 weeks that's going to fix all the issues you mentioned, you know, or many or most of the issues. You know, I would be fine with that even. You know, I don't mind the retail game having some issues if I know that the publisher give me enough time to give the developer feedback and the developer has already a patch plan, made good use of the time that they had instead of, you know, just building a hype machine and, you know, ending it with that.
Well, do we need to bring back the old concept of shareware games, where perhaps you get a stripped down version of NBA 2K, whatever, and you get to play a full game with the commentary and the play calling and everything. You get to play a full 48-minute game overtime, obviously if it goes to overtime.
But
you would have to still play. You would have to still get the full version to play season. Association,
yeah,
etc. So basically, the shareware version would essentially be a detailed demo, is what I'm saying. Because back in the day, you get some platformers for PC. I'll throw a name, one title out there, Jazz Jackrabbit. I don't know if you guys ever played that back in the day. But you could play it had, I think, 6 episodes or something of the game. And you could play through the entire first episode, 6 levels or whatever it was. But that wasn't finishing the game. It was finishing 1/6 of the game, if that. And that was the model back then of shareware. So do you sort of bring back that concept with a more detailed demo for the beta testing and to give people an idea? Because for many years, I was playing the 2K demos and thinking, well, what's everybody talking about? Because they're so stripped down. But if I'd been able to play a full game and actually get the whole experience, it wasn't until I actually sort of bit the bullet and bought 2K10 on PC that I actually said, oh, okay, yes, this is actually a lot going on here. Because all the demos I'd played up until then were so limited. So do you... Yeah, I'm all for actually putting a bit of effort into the demo and giving people a glimpse that's actually going to... If you show people how good the game is, that's going to sell the game.
Yeah.
And it's...
Limited demos aren't showing any confidence in your product, you know?
No.
It only shows people that you're deliberately hiding features that you're afraid will be broken. You can use all the excuses you want, but when we can see smaller and bigger studios than the one you're participating in, you know, bringing us proper demos, and you keep crippling the demos, you're not showing any confidence in your product. And we've praised 2K13 to no end, but, you know...
The
demo sucks, and we could have given them so much earlier feedback if they planned the demo, made it a bit earlier, and actually, you know, gave the people enough time on the demo to actually, you know, give proper feedback.
It was released like barely a week before the game actually released, wasn't it?
That's
a fucking pointless exercise.
Yeah.
Like.
Yeah.
at least a month, you know, so that way people can get familiar with it, give that feedback.
Or at least when the game gets cold, you know.
Yeah.
When the game gets cold, I don't know how much time that needs, a month before the release or whatever. When the code is locked, so you don't have to worry about the demo being an older version, you know, just move all the features you don't want the people to access. Maybe that takes a week, 2 weeks, or whatever. Get the demo out and give people the proper time to tell you what's wrong with your final code, you know? Even if you don't want to give people access to your non-final code, so you know maybe problems that you would later on fix would make for criticisms, if you're not clear that that's a beta and not a demo. So you know, I agree with Ben. It's a pointless exercise to have a demo come out a week earlier than the game. Say that the demo is not representative of the full product because it was a demo that's not of the final build, and then give people only 2 minutes with it.
Yeah, and have it so stripped back.
Pointless. It's pointless on so many levels.
It's kind of like doing it just for the sake of it. Like, oh, we've got that's the done thing to put a demo out, so here you go, but, kind of thing.
But it'd be expensive, like, just the shit costs and the timing and all that. It was like, just... What's the fucking point?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think 2K's marketing needs to work on that shit. Like, if they're going to release a demo, do it more than 1 week, 2 weeks beforehand. Give people the time with it.
It's their complacency, you know, being a factor as well. By the time they were to release a demo, they knew they had no one opposing them.
Yeah.
So they knew everyone that loved basketball
Can that be the dagger in the chest, though? Can they have that
mentality? It all depends. It all depends on whether EA finally makes a game, you know?
Yeah. I know.
Finally, not makes a game, but actually, you know, goes through the process of marketing so that, you know, 2K at least is aware of a competitor, no matter if that competitor hasn't kept up yet. Because if EA provides a demo that's, you know, a full game long, and, you know, even 3-minute quarters, 4 3-minute quarters, gives the people access to replays and substitutions and play calling and, you know, pretty much every feature of the gameplay, people are going to enjoy the demo more, even if it's not on par with the 2K game as gameplay, you know?
Yeah.
They'll have more time to actually, you know, appreciate the good things and criticize the bad things so that EA can make better use of the feedback. If 2K, you know, actually goes with what we have is perfect, you don't need to know what we have before release day. And that's why 2K keeps putting up those silly pre-order incentives. Mm-hmm. You know, they're saying, give us your money before the moment you know if the game is worth anything. And we give you All-Star Weekend Day 1. That's why I really hate pre-ordering. And I've only done it for, you know, very few games. For example, I pre-ordered Trials Evolution because I would have access to the beta. I would know that any problems I would contribute would help the developer. And also I had played Trials Evolution, the very same game on Xbox 360. I knew what I was paying for before I got it. So you have to give people proper incentives to pre-order the game, but, you know, apparently people are stupid and are cheap and are going to pay for whatever you throw at them. And especially as long as 2K has no opposition, it can keep, you know, it can keep going for that same recipe. You know, a crippled demo, people are still going to pay for the game because there's nothing else to play if you want to play proper basketball. So that's why we've been saying time and time again that any competition is better than no competition. We're not expecting EA to bring out a great game year one, first time they release it, but they need to get something that's properly playable out there so that even if just to use the feedback to get a good game out after 2 or 3 iterations. No game means no community feedback, means nothing to base your product upon other than, you know, your own intuitions. And we know how more times than not, it's the management intuition and not the developer's intuition.
Yeah.
Which leads to even bigger debacles. You know, I can't imagine many Maxis developers hoping that the game had such draconian DRM and hoping that the game's experience for a game that's been, you know, single player for so long would be absolutely dependent on whether the servers could handle the load.
Yeah.
No developer wants to be the subject of, you know, all the game's troubles because nobody can play even the single player portion of the game because something that's out of his reach, you know, the developer that worked, for example, you know, on all the buildings, on all the cityscaping and stuff like that, he doesn't want to be on this, on the sides of the end users because something that's far out of his hand, you know, that the servers didn't keep up with the load, you know. Everyone is blaming the developers now. And they, it's not their fault that, you know, EA didn't plan for proper servers, the proper server capacity. So it's a slippery slope, and I really believe that the best way to handle this is to give the community proper ways to give you feedback before the official release, either through a proper demo, or even if you can, you know, if you can, if you are willing to take the risk, that could, you know, it's a big risk with big rewards if you take it, you know, go through with the beta.
Absolutely. Now let's see it happen. Let's see it happen more
yeah.
often.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, those are the two pieces of news I wanted to discuss from the past week. Anything on your mind, guys, of, you know, anything from the past week you want to bring to the discussion?
Andrew?
Yeah, I don't have a lot going on this week.
Okay, so moving on, Zhao Ming gave us a few subjects to talk about, since this time apparently we ran out of subjects early. Imagine that. So, yeah. So first question is, and of course, you know, if anyone from the community wants to, you know, give us something to discuss, or you want to ask us guys anything, feel free to bring up your questions in anyone in any of the podcast discussion threads, or you know, if it's in the general talk or NBA basketball talk or any of the other forums, if you want us to bring it up in the podcast, make sure to say so, and we'll do our best. So Jasmine asks, first thing is, are we jealous of console my player features, 3v3 online console accessories, and my team? And I know Ben, of course, isn't jealous of any of that because you're playing on the PS3, so you're not missing out on any of it. And Andrew, for whatever reason, he has been pretty clear about.
I want the closet, damn it.
Yeah, yeah, that he wants the closet, damn it.
You just wanted to come out of it.
Man.
So with that in mind, do we miss the features that are missing, those features that are missing from the PC version? And Ben, you know, to put that question another way so you can participate, would you miss those features if they weren't there in the version you were playing, but you were aware that they were there? Oh God, that's a nice tongue twister. So, if you were aware that they were there in another version of the game, so do you want to go ahead? Would you miss my team and those and the fluff in my player in 3v3 on land, of course?
Well,
if it wasn't there,
from what I've seen with it and played around, like to sort of see what the fuss is all about with it, for me, it's too light for where it, like, I'd take it so much further than where it can go right now. It's too basic. Like it's too beginners at that stage. That there is a lot of things you could do with it to sort of give it more of a purpose in that. But we'll see if 2K do that, or whether it's going to be more paid DLC for next season, whether they try and give you a few more options and a few more purposes to having.
Experience the excitement of the D-League.
Yes.
Only $9.99.
Yeah.
Oh, don't say it. It's going to happen.
Well, yeah.
But for PC users, yeah, they're admittedly not missing too much in a lot of ways. And the fact that the community can do a shitload of stuff in regards to doing better takes on what is available and the options and all that stuff. You know, some of the things that we were doing for NBA Live back in the day were shitloads better than what is offered in the console versions of for 2K. I'll put it at that.
Yeah, yeah. That's the main. I think, Andrew, we both agree that that's the main excuse we have to not be bothered at all by missing features on the PC. As long as we get the core game and we have guys as devoted as Vlad and, you know, everyone else on making the tools and also the all our modders on making the game better, I wouldn't mind, you know, missing out on features like that. As long as we have a core game that we can somehow manage to mod.
Well, since I've been forced out of the mic closet, I better clarify my position.
Nice way to put it. That's you know, you're just looking for us to be kicked out and, you know, have harassment suits on our ass.
I guess we'll be hearing from your lawyers in the coming days.
Yeah absolutely.
I'm very
go.
We use the word not enough dongles in NBA 2K13. every game should come with a dongle. But, for me, it's kind of the principle of the thing. I mean, with my career, missing the close, it's not a big thing. But it's kind of, as I've said before, sometimes I'm playing and thinking, well, you spent all this time on that instead of fixing the grading logic or this and that, and then I don't even get it. So it's the principle logic of the thing. Yeah, it's the principle of the thing. And the same goes with the dunk contest and the three-point shootout. It would be nice to have it broken, and in the case of the dunk contest, as stupid as it may be. But as far as being jealous, no. I can certainly do without it. I've been enjoying 2K13 too much to really be jealous of that. I am jealous of the support they get, the fact they have the official patch months ago and we still haven't got it as we're approaching April.
Yeah.
I did make some inquiries and LD2K did say he'll get back to us. Hopefully we might get an answer in the next couple of weeks and the patch in the next month. Who knows? That's what I'm jealous of, the support. And we've discussed why the PC isn't a priority, so we don't need to go into that again. But if there's anything that I envy, it would simply be that the consoles do get the attention that means that the paying customers get the support if you're on that platform. And I, as I've said before, I do believe even if we are paying the lower price point, we are still paying customers, so we should still get some support and some answers. But that's the only thing.
Not royally screwed up the ass.
Or totally ignored if there's nothing to say. Even to say there's nothing to say, that just sort of ignoring the questions about it, it's a bit disappointing. My team, I mean, it sounds good, and I'd probably give it a go if it was in the game, obviously, but no, I can do without it, basically. That's my long, rambling answer to that question. I can do without it.
Yep. I'm totally on board with that. You know, I totally agree that the modding we've had, you know, the recent years, and modding was what got me into creating tools to facilitate modders so that they could in their, you know, in consequence make mods easier and get me a better game experience. In the end, it all comes in a circle, you know. In whatever stage of the modding, cycle that you contribute, whether you're a tool user, whether you're a modder, or whether you're just, you know, someone that criticizes and contributes, you know, their thoughts and ideas on a mod, you're making, you know, everyone's lives better. And modding, The amount of modding and the level of modding we've achieved with the NBA 2K series and, you know, that was done on NBA Live some years back, you know, trumps most of the console features that could be added, you know, that, you know, could make me jealous.
Yeah, well, seriously, three words, ultimate base roster.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, you know, that nothing that, no feature that could ever be brought to the consoles would, you know, trump in anyone's mind, you know, the project that is Ultimate Base Roster. And that's, you know, that's why last week I was, you know, so emphatic about wanting it to see come to the newer games, you know.
Yep.
Especially if we're to live through a transition to a new generation of games. You know, imagine that. Imagine, you know, the next generation with something as big as Ultimate Base Roster. So, I'm not really jealous. I remember back in the early podcast, up to episode 6 before the game was released, when we last discussed with John whether my team is even in the PC version, because it was, I think, the feature set had just came out and my team was nowhere to be seen in the PC version, so that was the first indication, and the true one at that, as it turned out, that my team wasn't in the PC version. I was discussing that I would love to try my team, but considering how much I don't really enjoy playing online, and, you know, back then we weren't even sure if online was going to be a proper experience on the PC, I was saying that, you know, maybe I would be better off doing a fantasy draft in association, since that choice is there, you know, and completely randomize the teams. And see how that league turned out. But, you know, again, we've funnily enough, we're complaining about all these weird trades happening and, you know, trades that are unrealistic. But, you know, you have to consider, you know, such big blockbuster and head-scratching trades that take part in the official league. And that extends to other matters as well. You know, for example, a few weeks ago, we were discussing on the SimNation radio show of, you know, of Dazar, we were discussing what is Sim Basketball. And, you know, there are things that we see in basketball every day that if we saw in 2K or NBA Live, we would be screaming out of the rooftops that that's not Sim. For example, remember the Jordan Crawford alley-oop pass to Blake Griffin, the recent one, where Jordan Crawford were between the legs or something, you know,
a ridiculous
alley-oop.
Jamal Crawford, yeah. That was ridiculous, you know. That was something that, if it was implemented in the gameplay of 2K, everyone would be crying out that that should be limited to the blacktop. Nobody does that in real games.
That's street bullshit.
NBA Live 2002, for example, had between legs dunks in games, but you could do them in traffic and with a very little run up. And that's the kind of thing. I mean, if they're sort of being generated in the middle of traffic out of nowhere, you wouldn't really see that. Or you might see it. You'd certainly see those players haul to the bench. So it's more about timing, I think. But you are right. I'm sure there would be some people that say that would never happen, even though we do see some ridiculous things.
Anyway,
would be more likely seen in an All-Star Weekend sort of event and all that, and not in a normal standard regular season game.
Or in the open floor, at least. In the open floor.
Definitely not in like a half-court situation where
you've got like a...
It'd just be ridiculously stupid. And
But to get back to my original point, you know, you don't need a fantasy draft to experience the game in such a random fashion, because with all the trades that have happened, I was, you know, it's each season proves to be a whole new and a newly interesting experience. Even if you start with the actual NBA teams, you know, sim or play to the second or third or fourth season even, and you're going to have such a different league, but you've, you know, if you've actually played or simmed carefully through it, it's going to be your experience. It's not to be, you know, a completely fantasy experience. It's going to be something that developed over the years. You know, players will have been signed out of fights in free agency, and trades will have been rejected, and others will have been approved, and the rumors will have been going on for a season, and, you know, stuff like that we've been talking about how we'd love to see them enhanced, you know, make the contract battles even more interesting and stuff like that. But, you know, even with this, even with what we have, it's so more interesting to see the seasons develop. And with you know, a weird trade that happens in as realistic a time frame as it happens in the real league, because not all trades in the real league make sense, you know.
True. I think that
who in their right mind playing, for example, NBA 2K7 or 2K8 would sign Villanueva and Ben Gordon in the free agency,
or trade Kwame Brown for Pau Gasol?
You know,
we do see that.
But
you go on, Ben.
Okay. I think with the amount of sort of crazy sort of unrealistic trades in the one season. Like, obviously, you have CP3 going to, and you got Dwight going to some other place, and then obviously KG going to some other place. There's too many big names that would go to teams that would so be also unrealistic that they'd go. Yeah, so unlikely that they'd go to. So, and you like, you maybe expect maybe one every or two every like every couple of years or something like that. But yeah, there's just, I think that it's the volume in which it happens in the game sort of makes it seem that unrealistic in a sense. So I think that's side argument that I'd go on with it.
That's what I was going to say. That's my feeling. It's that when it talks about realism, it's more about an overall lack of logic or reasoning, that the trades that are happening just for the sake of there being trades between the CPU teams. That players that are on teams that are winning randomly sign with a team that they would never sign with. Like Chris Paul going to the Cavaliers is probably the best example, with Kyrie Irving still there.
Yeah.
Just more, as Ben said, the volume. Just too many trades that don't really make sense, that are just there for the sake of having custom trades. And I do think, as you said, Leftos, that it becomes your experience and your fantasy experience with association in my career. That's the way it goes. So you've got to let go of some idea of what will happen, because chances are the team you're controlling is not going to win the championship. You know, if you're controlling your favorite team, only one team out of the 30 is going to win the championship, and it may not be your favorite team, but it probably will be in association. So some reality has to go out the window, but it is the case of when there's too many trades of, well, why would they do that? Or a team, one that I've seen a lot over the years is a player that's a big free agent acquisition. I'll give you an example from NBA Live 2001. That season, the Magic signed Grant Hill and Tracy McGrady. And in a franchise of 2001, I remember, before the trade deadline, the Magic traded McGrady to the Bucks for Ray Allen. Now, that was their big off-season acquisition. It seems unlikely that he'd be traded and of course, it does happen. We have seen people change their minds. We have seen it, and we've seen, even just this season, we've seen lottery picks get traded before they're even halfway through their rookie season. Thomas Robinson from the Kings to the Rockets. But it's rare, and it happens just a little bit too much with no rhyme or reason, just for the sake of having some player movement. And it's just tweaking that logic a bit.
So there's always the complaint about small market teams, you know, and it has been a recent discussion of ours, you know, small market teams getting big names when they're not even contenders. So that, things like that could be so easy to go in and, you know, have someone devoted to just work on that logic and maybe implement some very interesting stuff, like, you know, big markets, small markets, GM personalities. That was the whole reason, you know, we started discussing that, the new project with John.
Maybe one thing to take into consideration too, in a sense, like in a marketing sense. All right, I'll use the Dwight Howard situation as a key example of where I want to go, trying to take with this. With Dwight Howard going to a bigger market team, he was more guaranteed a more lucrative contract, like a $260 million contract from Adidas. If he went to a smaller market team, he wasn't guaranteed that sort of sized contract for his shoe partner. So it's something less aside incentive. From... Yeah, less incentives than that. So that could be a part of like a trade logic action, is the incentive, like if the contract with their part, with their sponsorships and all that, would this best serve their purposes and all that, in a financial stake as well. So aside from just a random trade logic idea, it's like taken to the principle concept, well, this person's shoe contract is expiring, this person is one of the top tier leagues in the play in the league. Obviously, big market, you're going to get more money from, as the marketing will be able to be there to sell your product. So I know, it's just it's one small thing that could play a key factor into where a player goes. That's the initial point that I want to bring up to it.
Extra layers of logic, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Of players having a brain and making decisions just as they do on the court with DNA and that kind of thing. So you've got that those layers on all aspects of the game. And I think one thing that occurred to me is when we say realism, we don't necessarily mean 100% true to life, because there has to be that fantasy aspect. It's just more what you'd expect to see, and a bit more logic and rhyme and reason to it. Because you a lot of people have said, "Oh, wouldn't it be great to implement real trades into the into a season?" And I know NBA Live 10 was doing that kind of with their dynamic season feature, which I thought was a good idea as an alternative, that you could play each day's games with the actual DNA and the rosters from each day. And as trades happened in real life, they also happened in the dynamic season. So you were still rewriting the results, but with real NBA data. And that was a good alternative to Dynasty. And I hope that future NBA Lives do incorporate that, because that was a good idea and a good solution to that suggestion.
Definitely. And but it did have a game-changer element to it as well.
Exactly. But you can't do that in Dynasty or Association. You have to let it go a little bit. But at the same time, you do want to see realism. Not 100% accuracy true to life, just things that reflect real life. So you will get some stupid trades from time to time, but not when every trade is a stupid trade, or at least half of them make absolutely no sense for either side.
Or,
it's just
or have,
for the sake.
Have Spock going, that's illogical.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Does not compute, I completely agree. You know, with the way the discussion has gone, we need realistic aspects in our games, and we need, and you know, even the dynamic season would be a great addition. But again, you know, I still wouldn't want to play dynamic season. I would prefer to have a dynasty that was more realistic, you know, because I don't want my hand to be forced. I want to be able to make my own trades. And if, you know, the Pistons management remains as stupid as ever, I want to be able to be the GM, because
that's
kind of the point.
That's the appeal. That's the appeal of association.
Add dynamic season if you want to do it, and I'm fine with that, and I can see how that will be a very popular move. But you know, I still want to see. That's not the way to avoid implementing your own realistic trade system.
No, it's definitely an alternative, and that's you know, I didn't mean to imply otherwise. That's definitely. To me, that it makes it a way of having some more meaningful exhibition games when you don't feel like playing a dynasty or association or whatever. It's definitely an alternative, kind of like the NBA Today feature in 2K, but with more ramifications, because then you could go ahead and play the custom playoffs with your altered results of dynamic season. So definitely as an alternative, not as a replacement. I think you need that fantasy aspect, because that is the grand appeal of the sports video games, that you can take control of your favorite teams and players, but also influence results more to your liking, shall we say.
Yeah, absolutely. John actually posted two videos that were back when the PS3 and Xbox 360 were announced, and how they would, you know, look like in the new, in the next generation. And one video was from 2K6, and one was from Live 06, and those were, you know, the slightly touched up videos of how they wanted their games to look in this generation. And he asks, have they met their goals? I took a look at both videos, and I have to say, although the player models are, you know, way beyond what we were looking at back in 2005, when those games were to be released, there are a few things that I guess were sacrificed, because there's so much processing power in those consoles as time went on. For example, the crowd in the 2K6 video actually looks better than what it looks like in 2K13.
Yeah.
And it seems more dynamic. And what else? The floor has great reflections, which, you know, have been toned down in recent iterations, and I'm not really sure why that happened.
The commentary in the NBA Live 06 video talking about they'll probably draw up a play for Allen and sort of really specific commentary, which we've kind of got, but not quite to that extent.
Yeah. You know, I always love, you know, the comments near the end of the game where a timeout is called and they discuss whether there's enough time for a comeback. But it would be amazing to see them, you know, go take it a step further and maybe, you know, discuss during the timeout, discuss the strengths of a particular guy, if they discuss their fourth quarter stats, you know.
Yeah.
It makes it seem that the MLB 2K team had paid so much more attention to stat presentation, you know, with all the criticism that's been there for MLB 2K, and, you know, MLB 2K13 deserves all the criticism it can get, you know, we have to be honest about it. The presentation team actually did a great job in the stats and the commentary on stats. For example, you know, you see stats specific to a player going up against another player, and stats that, you know, that player is now on two strikes and two balls. What's his stats, you know, when he's been in this position? So yeah. You would imagine that with all the access that 2K has to its own game engine, it could keep track, for example, of clutch stats and have the commentary team discuss that dynamically and say which player would probably be the best choice considering, you know, the team's last year, the player's last year clutch stats, or, you know, this season so far.
Or
you know,
even
who
the game.
Would be a great choice.
Even
through the game, yeah, you know. They could go into such more detail on stuff like that as far as the commentary goes. And we have to compliment TK for improving commentary as years go by. The demos and the gameplay videos never do justice to the improvements that the subtle improvements that the commentary has every year. And especially, you know, since TK10 implemented the dynamic commentary in the season that, you know, commentators would discuss the stats so far and stuff like that. And 2K13 went to so much length to implement deeper stats. For example, you know, discussing big men stats on their own, discussing rookies on their own.
Yeah.
You know, and you know those outliers, for example, big men that are very good at free throws, you know, stuff that you wouldn't, you know, you would see, you hadn't seen anyone recommend they should add. You know, they have been doing great work with the commentary every year, but there's still, you know, room for improvement. So, but, you know, graphics-wise, I have to say that, you know, with the animation fluidity that we were excited about it in 2K11, then 2K13 came along and trumped all over anything that we had seen in basketball games as far as animation fluidity goes, and, you know, the minimizing of canimations, as we call them, you know, animations that are predetermined and last a long time and that you can't get out of. I have to say that they've reached most of their goals as far as graphics and animation goes. And but, you know, there is a limit. When you develop for a console, you're going to hit the ceiling of that console sooner or later, and then you're going to have to sacrifice other stuff. And it's not just processing power, it's even storage. For example, having to work with the limited space that a dual-layer DVD gives you was what led 2K to actually lower the quality of the audio from going from 2K9 to 2K10. The dynamic commentary actually took up so much space that they had to go with a very much worse quality for the audio. I mean, go back to listen to 2K9 and 2K9's music, you know. It's the same quality that you would get from, you know, playing music on your favorite media player or playing your CD at home. And go then to listen to the music or commentary of any game since 2K10, and it's like listening to an AM radio station, you know? there are sacrifices to be made, and if developers aren't developing the games for PC first and nerfing them for consoles later, it's going to be like that on each generation. Certain features are going to have to be sacrificed for other features.
Yeah.
But I'll have to say that 2K, I haven't paid much attention to, you know, NBA Live, because it was console exclusive after 2008.
Yeah.
So I don't know what they've done, and we haven't seen how far we haven't gotten such a good look at how far they would have gone as far as animations go and graphics go, as you know, with the last 3 years. But 2K has done a good job to even, you know, surpass what they were what their expectations were for next gen. Your take on this, guys, Andrew?
Yeah, actually, looking back at those videos, I mean, you can see what they were going for, but I'd say seeing some of them, like the NBA Live 06 video, some of those animations are very stiff, and perhaps more like some of the problematic animations we were seeing in the previews of NBA Elite 11, compared to what they got to with NBA Live 10, for example, and NBA Live 09 as well. Yeah, I think they got there. I think there were issues with them, and certainly issues with between control and animations and whatnot, but I feel they got there. 2K certainly has. I think 2K exceeded what I saw in that video. And it's funny, it reminded me of going back and looking at some of the early Nintendo 64 games, which were so appealing at the time, but you go back and think, because it's the roundabout the turn of the whole 3D revolution.
And you
look back and go,
the transition from Pokemon, the transition from Pokemon Gold to Pokemon Stadium. I mean, oh my god! That nerdy child in me back in primary or secondary school—I don't remember what it was—was so excited, you know, to have 3D Pokemon battles.
Yeah,
it was that. It was the revolution in 3D. I mean, going from. Even more subtle changes, you know, from the 2D scrolling sports games to the first proper 3D games. And even, I don't know if you're familiar with, you know, the iterations that FIFA had, you know, the transition from FIFA 2002 to the World Cup version that year was, you know, amazing. You know, both games were 3D, but there is that one iteration that finally the new engine makes it in. And, you know, everyone is mind-blown.
You just notice, yeah.
But yeah, you just can't, you know, avoid but notice. We're talking about 2002. That was, you know, the old gen now.
Yes, yes.
There's going to be the sixth generation
of consoles, I think. Sixth generation, I believe that is.
There's going to be always something to impress us. I mean, back there was a time back when games... But computers didn't have enough processing power, so, for example, adventure games could get away with hand-drawn backgrounds, which were extremely beautiful, and then you could maybe animate just a river, you know, and still get away with it, because they were amazingly drawn, pseudo-3D backgrounds. But you don't have to do that anymore, and we're just going to be more and more impressed, and you have to wonder... When companies finally manage to harness the power of next gen, you know, and the PCs of the time, what the hell are we going to see? How much more can we be impressed? I mean, I was awed by the detail in the facial animations of L.A. Noire back in, 11?
Yeah, 2011.
That was all motion capture, wasn't it? That was
was motion capture, but that was the most detailed motion capture ever made. I mean, it was 32 cameras just for the face.
Something. But the downside was when they were recording it, the mocap for the body sequences were separate recordings, because the actors were sitting in chairs with these 32 cameras.
Cameras were all pointed to a specific spot, and they were all, you know, pre-calculated to watch specific parts of the face, so the actors couldn't be moving along and still have all this detail in their faces captured. And that, you know, I know where you're going with this. The animations of the body sometimes didn't match up with the animations of the face, and
yeah.
the more the most common problem, the most
the betraying of the emotion and all that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it's had some unnatural tones in some ways.
The most common issue people had with that was that the eyes didn't match the angle of the body.
Yeah.
You know, it was pretty much obvious that the person should be looking at a specific point, but the eyes were pretty much dead because they had to record the head and the body separately. You know, but you have to wonder, you know, if that was done by a studio that nobody knew, you know, Tim Bondi in 2011,
yeah,
with the support of Rockstar, of course. You have to wonder, you know, where are we headed? How much are we going to be impressed in, you know, the next years? Especially now that, as we discussed, developers will have the power of the next generation consoles to work with, because most developers don't work with what's, you know, the latest and greatest on the PC. If it were like that, you know, PC would have seen, you know, the supposed, the quote-unquote next-gen games much earlier. The PC would always be the current gen, you know?
Yeah.
Well, except for the first year, for the first years of console releases, where, you know, the hardware is in consoles might be on par with PCs, but then the overhead is much smaller, so consoles outperform PCs for the same graphics. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you have to wonder, were the developers allowed to work with what was the latest and greatest on the PC? What would we have seen now? And, you know, even without that, and with the next generation consoles coming out and with the processing power they will have, what is in the future? What does the future hold for us? You know?
Well,
it's really exciting.
I did want to mention, like, when you talked about Tim Bondi and working on L.A. Noire. I mean, that was an 8-year project. But what happened shortly after release was a lot of information about that studio, and basically the CEO of that studio, he was working his stuff 100 hours a week, unpaid extra, which is fairly unfair. But what's happened in the studio since then closed, but it has been given new life, and they are working on a new game, and it's called Horror of the Orient.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a new...
Have they said they're going to use the same technology as before?
Not sure if it's that motion scan sort of technology that I think they were calling it. But at the moment, there's only just really like one or two screenshots from it, and it's a next-gen title, and it looks pretty freaking impressive.
Yeah.
I'll send you it now.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, clearly we have to... What we have to look forward to is realistic laces on the shoes.
And when the player bends down to actually tie them up, they actually do tie them up.
And when the player is actually stepping on other people's feet and giving them a flat tire, and shoes coming off, and pick up the shoe and swat at the ball,
and
like
then throw it into... Yeah, it'll throw the shoe into the crowd, so that way the player has to basically essentially lose their position on defense.
Joking aside, do you know the one thing that I'm
joking.
Really excited about?
Who says we were joking?
Okay. So with that aside, the one thing I'm most looking forward to by harnessing the additional power is the collision detection, you know, seeing that being improved.
Yeah. For me, like, when the Euphoria engine came out, or Natural Motion engine came out, sorry, I should say, you know, there was a lot of cool things that, from what I've seen in, like, little developer videos and showing you how you can sort of get full collision detection, even in bloody individual fingers and that. And I've been waiting for that in a sports game for a while, because... For me, it was representing a true way to simulate injuries, fouls. For instance, if contact with the ball, if the ball goes out, you know, if it could have those little tension moments of who's the ball last off kind of thing, for a little added dramatic
effect.
Absolutely.
It was about capturing that realism, you know, of what to expect. And for me, I've been waiting years for studios to be able to do that, and I'm hoping that with this next generation that's coming out later this year, so early next year, that we'll be able to get to that stage. And
it's all about, you know, you have to consider that there is a limited amount of times a second you can check where the player's hand is and where the ball is.
Yeah.
You know? So and the additional processing power should allow them to calculate that many more times a second, so that force field should be, you know, minimized as we go on, because they will be able to update the position of the ball much faster, more times, so they don't have to have that artificial distance just in order to avoid clipping, because that's the only reason, you know, the ball is so far away from the hand is not to allow, you know, the palm or the fingers to go through the ball.
Yeah. Well, EA were a lot better with that, with the ball in the hand situation, and I think Live 08, I think maybe had it like a slightly better like hand on rim interaction and all that stuff from memory on next gen, without the clipping effects or sort of like their hand hanging in sort of midair. But like 2K, for me, it still shits me off that the ball is hovering off their hands by like 1 or 2 inches and all that. But yet they focused on 2K13 on trying to iterate the hand detection and all that stuff on the rim. You know, we spent so many hours developing that, but why didn't you focus on getting the fucking ball to actually stick in their hand instead of
it? You know, they say that you'll see players hang on to the rim and the rim will bend, but there's still that force field there, you know?
Yeah.
I would have kept that, you know, as a selling point until it was actually that much impressive, because you go to watch, you know, old game videos and it's not new, seeing players hang on to the rim.
Yeah.
It's nothing new, but you know, I would have that as a major selling point if you could see the player's fingers actually surrounding the rim and have almost no distance between the rim and the fingers, or when you could see the ball actually, you know, go up against the fingertips.
Yeah,
at least that, you know, minimize the distance as much as you can. Then I would make that a selling point and actually show a video, you know, of a very slow motion replay of the ball approaching the hand and how close they've managed to get it. Because the first thing I went to check out in NBA 2K13 was that, you know, going to practice, play around with the ball a bit and go into instant replay and see how close the ball was to the hand, then dunk and see how close the fingers were to the rim. And I was disappointed, you know. From all the marketing and those developer videos, I was expecting to see, you know, to see it much better. And I have to respect, you know, the developers for all their work. I'm blaming, you know, the marketing team that decided to put so much focus on that.
Yeah.
Because when you put it on it is progress. You know, I have to say that it is incremental progress relative to previous years. It is progress, but on an absolute manner, it is not that impressive yet. You know?
Agreed.
It's very distracting when you go into that instant replay and you do see the ball floating out of the hand, or the player hanging on the net, or indeed midair. And when you're trying to take a nice screenshot or something, it really does.
Or when you mentioned, you know, who the ball touched last on an out-of-bounds call, you know?
Yeah.
I can never tell. If it is close, you have no idea, because the ball bounces off two force fields.
Yeah.
And you have no idea which force field is of which player. You have just to trust the game that, you know, that wasn't a glitch. The referee made the right call.
Although, then again, referee error, maybe that's unintentional realism. Just like the stupid Twitter comments. It just works out nicely.
Maybe, just maybe. Anyway.
Another thing in regards to I was playing 2K13 the other day, and there was an instance where I think the ball got swatted, and then the ball hits, it bounces off a player's face, but doesn't actually quite bounce. It spins on this player's face for like a few moments, like a damn seal doing a circus trick.
I keep seeing that with the ball being stuck on players' heads or neck.
Yeah.
You would imagine it would slide off.
I know. It's not going to be like that half court shot where the ball ends up just getting wedged between the rim and the backboard some freaking how. It's like, yeah.
And we've seen the 3D head shapes. I mean, the 3D head shapes are very detailed. You know, the geometry is there, but it seems like the collision detection, as far as the head goes, is a flat surface. Maybe, you know, No, I'm not joking. I mean, that's maybe, you know, a valid compromise considering the processing power they have to deal with.
Yeah.
Maybe if they had to make the collision detection take into account the whole geometry of the head, maybe that would be too taxing to the current consoles. So that's, you know, that's a lot of things that can improve with additional processing power. So that's, you know, all the more reasons to be excited about what the future holds.
Well, yeah. I just think that if something like that happens and the ball's stuck spinning on someone's head in a rather comical manner, you should be able to input a button code and have it just starts whistling the Harlem Globetrotters.
That's awesome.
That's what... If next gen can't bring that, then there's no point getting, you know...
There's no point in living.
Yeah, okay, so we have to wrap up, guys. I have things to attend to, and we have been running for 2 hours and 30 minutes total. So if there's anything quick you have to get out of your chest or, you know, tell the community about, do it now. Otherwise, Andrew, do the honors and wrap it up.
I got one quick thing.
Okay, go ahead.
During last week's podcast, when Leftos was one of his big monologues, sorry, man. I sort of decided to create a few jersey patches for NBA Live. So I'm contemplating whether I return or whether this is more just, again, portfolio stuff. So there could be some release, again, admittedly for Live 06, just because graphically-wise, that was far superior out of the NBA Live games, and I really don't have any interest patching for 2K since I don't have that fond attachment to it like I do with NBA Live. So, yeah, I know. I just play it just to kill time, in a sense. So, yeah, I don't have any affiliation, attachment.
I'm glad my rants get the creative side out of it, you know?
Yeah, well, I gotta kill half an hour somehow. But I do miss patching it, and I was like, I did dip my feet in it earlier or later last year and that, with a couple of jerseys and that, which I hadn't admittedly finished yet. But I don't know, if I have the time over the coming months, I might do a couple of things, but I wouldn't say it's a full comeback yet. It might be just a once every now and then thing, just because I do miss it. You know, it's a lot of fun, but I really would like to see a next gen PC release and that. Just especially for Live. You know, growing up with playing it, I feel like that. I'm connected to it more. So,
We will have current rosters to go with any of those patches, Ben. So I'm getting very close to being able to release those. So.
Nice.
If you're still playing those old games, we're going to keep you covered for a little bit longer. And but of course, check out what we're doing for 2K13. Up to 760 downloads, gentlemen. Facing 787 for 2K12, so it's almost eclipsed at less than 6 months of the game being out. So that's, once again, just an impressive, enthusiastic effort by our community. And we love the fact that you're using the upload facilities. Please keep them coming.
Yeah. One last thing. Just to reiterate on my favorite thought this week, let's hope the Heat win the championship. And on that note, Andrew, please wrap up.
Well, that's going to do it for episode number 22 of the NLSC podcast. As always, we hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes if you're into that kind of thing. Or just keep listening on the NLSC, nva-live.com. Follow us on Twitter at the NLSC. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/the NLSC. We're on YouTube, youtube.com/NBA Live Series Center. We can't change that. We registered years ago before we went back to just NLSC. Take it up with YouTube and Google, not us. And I don't know the Google Plus link because it's really complicated, but all the links are on the site. So nva-live.com, that's where it's happening. So, once again, that's going to do it. I am your draconian webmaster and administrator, Andrew.
I'm the master of the universe, Leftos.
And I'm the master of the unknown factor.
See you later, guys.
Bye-bye.
All right.